Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. Tonight, we learn about a group of snowmobilers who don't let a lack of snow stop their fun. We also talk to one of the authors of The Self-Destruction Handbook, 8 Simple Steps to an Unhealthier You. We see how Bloomsday was celebrated locally and learn about Jack Chick, the man behind those ubiquitous religious tracts. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Do the hot sun and high humidity get you in the mood for snowmobiling? Well, they do for some of the hardest core aficionados of Ski-Doos, Arctic Cats, and other high-powered sleds who have a place to get their fixes for snowmobiling even without snow. Tom Rogers takes us just outside Homer, which lays claim to the southernmost course for snowmobile drag racing.
Dave Compton took up snowmobiling as a hobby, but he couldn't bear to keep his hobby in the garage 8 months out of the year. Who needs snow?
It's like at work, I'll talk to guys and they'll say, well, what'd you do this weekend? Well, we went and rode snowmobiles in the grass and they think you're nuts. Come out and do it. Nah, we are a little bit, but still a lot of fun.
Dave, his friend Carl Flager, and Carl's wife Bev are now the Flager Racing Team. They make the rounds of grass snowmobile races, fanning out from their hometown of Tiscola in northern Illinois to places like Homer.
All right. Next up, in lane 1, number 4, lane 2, number 34 in the 700 single class.
If the sound of whining engines doesn't attract you to the Homer 500, you may be able to just follow the signs. As long as you keep an eye peeled for an unassuming course, it's on the outskirts of town, right past a few piles of gravel and the no dumping allowed sign. There are a couple races for all-terrain vehicles today, but it's the sleds that get most of the attention. It's just like a drag race for cars. Two snowmobiles line up in front of what they call the Christmas tree, the series of yellow lights with a green light at the bottom. It counts down for only 0.4 of a second. The sleds tear off into the distance, hitting 0 to 60 in about 2 seconds, some of them topping out at 100 miles an hour. Race Commissioner Aaron Finley says brakes, not big parachutes, are the only things that keep the sleds from barreling into the cornfields at the end of the strip.
Most of the time, when you're going down the track, the front end is just barely touching the ground, and they're set up to where they're very slick on the front end, so they don't turn very well on the grass. It's hard to get them turned. A lot of times you'll see the guy pick up the back end and spin it around to get it to turn. They're made, in this setup, they're made to go straight, so they don't turn very well at all.
Brute force can win you drag races. The highest speeds are reserved for the more customized snowmobiles, the ones that usually don't hit the snow-covered trails during the winter. But there are plenty of sleds here that do see double duty, summer and winter. Dave Compton is riding one of them, and it can still hold its own on the 500-foot grass drag strip.
As a matter of fact, I'm riding one for a buddy of mine, this one right here. It's a 79 Polaris 500. 79, that's 25-year-old sled, and we're still out racing them in the grass, and the thing gets with it. I just raced a guy that has a 2000 500. Stayed right with him. If I could have got a good light, I could have taken one of it.
What's even more important, though, is reaction time. Carl Flager says it's like a 6-second video game.
If you have a slow reflex, you may have the fastest sled, but you can still get beat if you're slow off the line. So it's a combination of a little everything, and good luck, too.
You've got 9 heats before you're up again, so you've got a while.
All right.
You need to stay on the clutches.
Since the races are so short and the engines get so hot, turnarounds between races are sometimes as important as the race itself. In those turnarounds, the Flagers pump ice water through the engine core between heats. Those are cold weather engines, after all, while Compton makes a quick change of belts. A speedy sanding of the clutch to rub off the melted rubber from the belt, and they're ready to go again. Racing gets in the blood, whether it's snowmobiles or cars, cold weather or hot. Alex McCara has become a helper to his son, who came down to Homer from Homer Township in Will County near Joliet.
I go chase some parts for him, buy some fuel for him and stuff like that, but other than that, he does all the racing.
It's quite a hobby, huh?
Oh, it's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun for you, even though you're not on the...
That's right. I started him when he was real young with a kitty cat, and he hasn't quit yet, and he's like 28 and going strong.
And when speed courses through your veins as fast as ice water, a lack of snow isn't going to stop you or your snowmobile. For Sidetrack, I'm Tom Rogers.
You're listening to Sidetrack. One of Champaign-Urbana's biggest summer events is the Taste of Champaign, which took place last month in Westside Park. Besides food from area restaurants, music, and arts and crafts, there are some other attractions. In a moment, we'll hear about an artist who uses an unusual set of tools. But first, one of the long-standing participants to the Taste of Champaign, the historic popcorn truck.
I'm Paul Eidelman. I'm the director for the Champaign County Historical Museum. Initially, this was a 1917 Creeder horse-drawn wagon. We have a picture of it in the window over here. In 1919 or 1920, Henry Sansone put it on a Model T truck body and brought it to Champaign. So it's been in Champaign since the early 1920s. In 1956, I think it was, or 54, Henry put it on this model, or I'm sorry, it's a 1940 Chevy truck chassis. And he retired, I think it was in 1974, and the truck sat in a barn in St. Joseph for years and years when the museum bought it. We've had a lot of people working on getting it refurbished and everything, including the Mass Transit District, the City of Champaign, Warden Martin, O'Brien Auto. A lot of people have donated their services to keep it fixed up and running.
Well, describe a little bit for it, because it's a very unusual looking truck.
It is. The body is pretty much original to the horse-drawn Creeder wagon. Creeder was a real famous maker of popcorn machines and cars and wagons. I know Henry Sansone originally had a push cart before he bought this, but... There's not too many of them left in the country. It's really quite a collector's item and really unique to Champaign County's history. A lot of people remember it. It was always on Neal Street in front of the Kreskes there for just years and years. But it's, I don't know exactly how to describe it. You know, it's a red body, but it has all the etched mirror original signs on it from the buttered popcorn and ice cream cones.
Now, this has been out at every Taste of Champaign?
It has. Since we've owned it, yes.
And does it go to other events during the year?
Yeah, you'll see it in the 4th of July parade every year. Different museum events. I know we're doing one event at the Virginia Theater in September with a symphony and a band called Flash Cadillac, and it'll be there. In fact, organizations, different events and things like that, usually if they just call us and we have it available and have volunteers available to work it, we're happy to take it there. We even drove it all the way to Homer about 4 weeks ago, and nice 40-mile-an-hour drive on the back roads going out, but coming back it was a little windy, so it was a 20-mile-an-hour drive. We've had a very generous offer from the Model A Club of Champaign County to get it back on a Model A truck, truck frame to get it how it looked with the Model T. I should point out that even though this is the horse-drawn version, when they put it on a Model T, it gave Kreeter the idea to come out with their own Model T, which they had for a few years, and then they switched it to a Model A. So we're working on fundraising right now to buy an old Model A chassis, and then the Model A Club's going to donate their time and Ward and Martin their services to refurbish this. Hopefully next year for the taste, it'll have a new look to it.
Your name and what are you doing?
Dave Watson. I'm the chainsaw carver here at the festival. They hire me. I come down from Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. I'll be doing 5 shows today, and then tomorrow I'll do 3 shows. Everything I do at the festival belongs to the festival. They're going to sell them by silent auction. Bidding ends tomorrow at 4 o'clock, and then the money goes into a fund for kids' children's scholarship.
You've done a couple already today. I see there's an eagle and a raccoon family. And then in front of you here are just a bunch of
logs.
Logs.
Mm-hmm. And
so do you know what they're going to be?
I have kind of a, I know what sells real well out of my shop. I have a shop up in the Dells. So I'll do things that do sell well to try to raise money for the festival here. But you also go with the character of the log and see what's in it. I play a game with the kids in the audience. If they can guess what I'm carving, there's a prize for the child that guesses. So I never tell what I'm carving to begin with, and so we'll just play around and see what happens here.
Okay, so you're looking at this log you've got standing on its side right now. Mm-hmm. What does this look like to you?
Well, I can't tell you.
And they're in all shapes and sizes. There's a huge, there's a big one over there. There's a one with kind of a forked one.
Yeah, they brought in some really nice character logs this year, and so the logs themselves have a lot of art to them to begin with, so... like the family of raccoons. I mean, there were 3 branches there, even a knob below, so we stuck the tail of the raccoon coming out of a hollow. So the pieces themselves have a lot of character, and that adds to the piece, so it'll be interesting this year.
So how'd you get started carving wood with chainsaws and power tools?
Well, I was a chef for 15 years, and during the middle of it or whatever, I had the opportunity. I went over to Europe, cooked in Europe, and I didn't speak the language, so I'm over there working in a kitchen, and so not speaking the language, I putzed with different food, and I started carving. They had chocolate over there. I started sculpting some chocolate, and then butter and cheese and different vegetables, and realized that ability to sculpt. So the last few years of cooking, I won some competitions in the ice, and then competed in the U.S. Open competition, and then I got really tired of babysitting people, so I decided to split off, and I saw somebody doing the wood, and I tried it myself and realized I had an ability to do it. So in the late 1980s or early 90s, I went into it full time.
How dangerous is it to carve with chainsaws?
Oh, I've got a few stitches.
Wow. That's a big scar.
Yeah. If the chainsaw hits you, usually they can't stitch it back together. So, yeah, it's a nasty tool, but it whittles fast.
Well, you got different sorts of chainsaws. Why don't you tell me kind of what you've got lined up here to use?
Well, I have the biggest saw that Husqvarna makes that I actually back at my shop. I have a 6-foot bar that goes on that one. It'll actually handle an 8-foot bar. And right now I've got a little over a 42-inch bar on it. Then I go all the way down to a 12-inch. So I can take some wood off fast, and I start with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 saws laying there, and there's usually a saw running at all times.
You've got a sander down there, and
I've got a little sander and a little belt sander and a blower, and it doesn't take more than 45 minutes to an hour, and I've got a piece done.
A couple of the more interesting attractions from this year's Taste of Champaign. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. Go into any bookstore and you'll find whole sections of self-help books. They always promote a better way of living or a way to a healthier you. But what about people who don't want to live good and healthy lives? There really hasn't been a how-to book for bad behavior until now. Adam Wasson, along with Jessica Stamen, have just put out the Self-Destruction Handbook, 8 Simple Steps to an Unhealthier You. It's published by Three Rivers Press. I recently talked with Wasson and asked him first if the world really needs a handbook for self-destruction.
I really think it does. I walked into a bookstore and I saw maybe 10,000 self-help books. We're talking books on how to stop smoking, how to stop drinking, how to stop eating carbohydrates, basically everything that you enjoy in the world, how to stop doing it. And it occurred to me, we need a book on how to enjoy our vices and how to do them better. If you like to smoke, how do you look cool while smoking? How do you meet girls while smoking? Things like that.
Well, that's just one of the topics that you cover in the book. What are the other steps? You say it's 8 simple steps to an unhealthier you, and there are 8 different subjects, and you said, and as I mentioned, smoking is one of them. What other self-destructive steps do you guys cover?
Well, we open with a classic one, which is 12 steps to a drinking problem. You know, there's no better way of indicating that you have a sort of wild, sexy, artistic dark side than having a drinking problem. That's why all your kind of Hollywood celebrities end up checking themselves into rehab. But it's not so easy to acquire one. And so you have to take it kind of one step, one drink at a time. The first step is just admitting that you don't have a problem and that you would like to get one. Other steps involve renouncing God as an important step. You know, and then we get into more advanced things, such as finding you're an enabler, engaging in an inappropriate and degrading alcohol-related sexual encounter, you know, more sophisticated techniques as you go on in the process.
You also have Your Brain on Drugs, The Rules for Dysfunctional Daters, The Man and Mistress Guide to Infidelity.
I feel that's a very important one, actually.
Yeah, how so?
Well, there are about 200 to 300 books out at any given time on how to improve your relationship with your wife. There is not one, other than the Self-Destruction Handbook, on how to improve your relationship with your mistress. And God knows we need it. I mean, somewhere between 50% and 70% of all men, by any survey, engage in some kind of infidelity over the course of their marriage. And without a book to tell you what to do in certain situations, such as, let's say, when your mistress calls up on the phone and your wife picks up and your mistress hangs up in a panic, you don't know how to handle the situation.
Well, how do you handle that situation?
Aha, I'm glad you asked. Well, the way to handle that situation is to go on the offensive. Rather than just sort of allowing your wife to hit star 69, right, and then get hold of the mistress on the other line, what you do is you say, who was that on the phone? And act jealous yourself. Take the phone away from her and say, I'll get to the bottom of this, and hit star 69 yourself.
And after that chapter about infidelity, you have one called Condoms Are for Suckers.
That, so far, that's been the most controversial. We've gotten a little bit of flack about that one, both in sort of reviews and on the website also.
Yeah?
Yeah. People are a little up in arms about that chapter. But, yeah, we feel it's important to look at the other side. I mean, the fact is, safe sex is not necessarily fun sex. And so we look at, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek, all the really silly sexual things that people do. And sort of have fun with those safe sex manuals. It's kind of a satire of those.
You also have How to Lose Way Too Much Weight in 90 Days.
That's maybe my favorite chapter, actually.
Because, really?
Yeah, because I just feel like there are so many weight loss books out there and videos and shows, you know, and they all make you feel bad about yourself for enjoying a decent meal. And, you know, especially the South Beach diet where you can't even eat any carbohydrates. And so what we came up with is the West Coast diet. And the fundamental tenet of the West Coast diet is stop eating. I don't know if you knew this, Jason, but eating is the single biggest hindrance to losing weight.
And your final chapter in the book is The Ins and Outs of Self-Mutilation.
that one is an attack on shows like The Swan. I don't know if you've seen the show.
Oh, yeah, the infamous show about giving makeovers and then having a beauty contest at the end.
Yeah, and it, but it's not just a makeover in terms of doing someone's hair, you know, or giving them a little makeup to shade an unfortunate blotch on their face or something. We're talking about massive surgical interventions where we're doing nose jobs and brow lifts and breast implants and liposuctions. And that's kind of what we're skewering in self-mutilation. We give various reasons to get breast enlargement, you know, and explain why it is that artificially implanted bags of fluid are so attractive to men. And, of course, we look at the other sex also, and we give reasons to have a penis enlargement as well.
So what drove you to write this book? I know you've mentioned that bookstores are way too full of other self-help books, but was that really the driving motivator to put all this on paper?
The number one reason that I felt like I had to do a satire of self-help culture was I saw one of those government-sponsored anti-drug advertisements in which they suggest that a teenager trying to cop a joint is supporting terrorism. And just the blatant hypocrisy of that ad, you know, like shifting responsibility for terrorism away from the administration's foreign policy blundering and on to hapless teenagers was too much to bear. And I just thought, I've got to write something that skewers this. And that's why the chapter Your Brain on Drugs was born, to attack that kind of hypocrisy in our culture, you know, and just say, look, yeah, too many drugs can be bad for you, but it's also a kind of an experimental thing that can be enjoyable, mind-expanding, whatever. And there are funny little bits in there. We have, for instance, the SAT for drug users, because I don't know if you knew this, but the traditional SATs are culturally biased against people who are on drugs. And so we created a test that evened out the biases.
You also have a little bit in that chapter, Your Brain on Drugs. Do you have the book handy?
Sure.
Can you read your blurb about peer pressure?
Oh, the peer pressure, sure, okay. People sometimes talk about peer pressure as if it is a bad thing, but it is not. If you were to cut yourself, for example, and no one applied pressure to the wound, you would soon bleed to death. Peer pressure is not unlike applying a tourniquet to the hemorrhaging social lives of your terminally uncool friends. People often try to pressure their friends by telling them drugs will make them cool or help them fit in, but this is rarely effective. We've all been well trained not to give in to such clumsy external pressures. A much more effective strategy when a friend says no to drugs is simply to walk away in mute disgust and refuse to say a single word to them ever again. By leaving them friendless and alone, you will have created an internal pressure that will build day by day as their loneliness and despair eat away at them from the inside. Eventually, there is a good chance that they will beg you for a second chance. And far from trying to convince them to try drugs, you will soon be asking them not to bogart your entire stash.
One of the many statements in the self-destruction handbook. Now, don't you feel that there's way too much self-destructive behavior out there already?
Well, sometimes, in some ways there is, yeah. And one of the things that this book does is it makes fun of people who go overboard with their self-destruction. I mean, it's a very tongue-in-cheek look at, you know, people who go really crazy with sex, for instance, like the Paris Hilton video. I don't know if you've heard the latest, but there's this photo of Paris Hilton out where she's buying her own sex video, and accompanying her is her 15-year-old brother, which is just really a little bit crazy. And so there's something that sort of gets after Paris Hilton in the chapter on dysfunctional dating. And so it's very much a guide that encourages a little bit of self-destructive behavior, but also satirizes people who take it a little bit too far. It kind of plays both sides of the fence.
Well, is there going to be a follow-up to this book? Even more self-destruction?
It's funny that you ask, because on the website, which is www.selfdestructionhandbook.com, a lot of people have been writing in and saying, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And right now, what I'm doing is responding to those questions on the website itself in a section of the website that's called Ask Adam. Anyone can just write in and ask a question. And if we get enough of those Ask Adams, we may very well just make a book out of them. And it should be a pretty funny book. I mean, if you log onto that website, again, it's selfdestructionhandbook.com, you can see there's an archive already building of interesting Ask Adam questions and then responses.
That was Adam Wasson, who along with Jessica Stamen have authored The Self-Destruction Handbook, 8 Simple Steps to an Unhealthier You. It's published by Three Rivers Press. Still to come on the program, we check in with the local celebration of Bloomsday, the day which James Joyce's Ulysses takes place. And we learn about Jack Chick, the man behind the famous, or infamous, series of religious tracts. Stay tuned. James Joyce's novel Ulysses explores a day in Dublin and the life of Leopold Bloom, with sly parallels to Homer's Odyssey. Even its fans say it's hard to read, but celebrations of Bloomsday, June 16th, the day in 1904 when the novel takes place, get bigger every year. Last month, a Bloomsday celebration in downtown Champaign ran from morning to night, rotating between several locations, most of them bars. Jim Meadows followed the festivities.
It's 8:30 in the morning, Saturday morning, June 19th. The actual Bloomsday was 3 days earlier, but this is the weekend. And at the Verde Art Gallery in downtown Champaign, a Bloomsday celebration is getting started. Edward Wewell is the first person to show up. He's already gone through Ulysses once in his lifetime, listening to the entire book on tape while driving.
Well, I don't know. I just find it interesting It all takes place in one day. It's kind of fascinating that you could put so much in there, and it's pretty risque, I guess, for the time.
In all, about a dozen people are on hand to listen to David Garrick, one of the local Bloomsday organizers, read from the first chapter of the novel, which opens on the morning of June 16th, 1904.
Chapter 1, Telemachus. Stately, plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and razor lay crossed. A yellow dressing gown ungirdled.
James Joyce started his novel Ulysses in an ordinary way on an ordinary day in Dublin. In the course of 18 chapters, Jewish ad salesman Leopold Bloom travels around the city of Dublin, sometimes in the company of the young tortured intellectual Stephen Dedalus, finally ending his day in bed with his wife Molly. That Bloom's journey has a parallel with the journey of Ulysses in Homer's Odyssey is just part of what's fascinated and frustrated readers for more than 80 years. There's also a wide range of literary styles, stream-of-consciousness writing, and risque passages that led Ulysses to be banned in America for 12 years. For Garrick, who has read through Ulysses 3 times, it's all part of the fun.
The book is extremely rewarding in that the energy you give it is given back to you 5 times over. Any effort you make in trying to sort of decode some of the more inscrutable parts, you discover every time that Joyce did have something that he was trying to do here, that there was something meaningful, maybe a little disguised, but something significant.
But Bloomsday is as much an occasion for music and revelry as it is for literary appreciation. Champaign-Urbana's Bloomsday Centennial featured Irish music throughout the day at various bars and coffee shops. In the outdoor sidewalk cafe of the Cowboy Monkey, members of the local Irish folk group Banish Misfortune played under the billing of Lenehan's Riddle, a reference to an anecdote in Joyce's novel.
And then she rose and let him in and kissed his ruby lips and chin. Then they went to bed again, the soldier had won her favor. Then she blessed the rainy night, oh, blow on a rainy night. Then she blessed the rainy night, that ever she lets him in.
At another nearby bar, Bentley's, lovers of Irish music gathered for Paddy Diggum's wake, a reference to a wake held in Ulysses, and some informal music making.
Road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3 for five. Hunt the hare and turn her down the rocky road and all the way to Dublin, what falls all there are. From there I got away, me spirits never fail.
The singer is Lisa Boucher, a local musician, and with Garrick, the co-organizer of Champaign Urbana Bloomsday. They started putting together Bloomsday celebrations in 2002. Boucher says she likes Joyce's novel for the rhythm and pulse of its language. She says she just plowed through the parts she didn't understand, and she hopes others who came to Bloomsday events will do the same.
Actually, I've talked to several people that have just decided that they're going to, or they have just started reading it because they heard this was coming up and found out that they're actually enjoying it. It's a really funny book. It's hilarious. I think that anybody can read it if they just dare to read it. I dare you. I dare you to read Ulysses.
Ulysses was read all day during Champaign-Urbana Bloomsday. Starting with that 8:30 a.m. reading from the book's first chapter, the readings continued at various places around downtown Champaign. One of the readings was on the air. Over at the Market Street studios of WEFT Radio, Garrick joined Carl Estabrook on his arts program from Bard Diverse. Together they read from the chapter known as Ithaca, where Leopold Bloom and the young Stephen Dedalus arrive at Bloom's home. Joyce uses the question and answer format of a catechism to describe, often in extreme detail, the late night events.
What action did Bloom make on their arrival at their destination?
At the house steps of the fourth of the equidifferent uneven numbers, number 7 Eccles Street, he inserted his hand mechanically into the back pocket of his trousers to obtain his latchkey. Was it there?
It was in the corresponding pocket of the trousers which he had worn on the day but one preceding. Why was he doubly irritated?
Because he had forgotten, and because he remembered that he had reminded himself twice not to forget. What were then the alternatives before...
Estabrook, who read Ulysses in college, says he finds a madness in the book that makes him wonder about James Joyce's sanity. In fact, Estabrook thinks Joyce was half nuts, and he thinks the author's mental instability contributed to his writing.
I think what he does is take all of that madness and his substantial learning. I mean, he does have a remarkable range of association, and put it together with all his anxieties as glue, and the result is this amazing Gaudi-like cathedral that's Ulysses.
At the Great Imposter Restaurant, Mike Healy and WILL-FM's Roger Cooper read from the chapter known as Sirens, in which the parallel to the sirens that taunted Ulysses and Homer are two barmaids who taunt the main character in Joyce's Ulysses, Leopold Bloom.
Married to the greasy nose,
she yelled.
Shrill with deep laughter, after gold, after bronze, they urged each other to each, to peal after peal, ringing in changes, bronze, gold, gold, bronze, shrill deep, to laughter after laughter, and then laughed more.
Greasy, I knows.
Exhausted,
breathless.
Their shaken heads they laid, braided and pinnacled by glossy combed against the counter ledge, all flushed,
oh,
panting, sweating,
oh,
all breathless.
Married to Bloom, to Grease Bloom.
Shelley Cordulac of Champaign is part of the group listening to the reading. Her experience with Ulysses, like those of many others, harkens back to college. She says her enjoyment of Joyce's novel isn't dependent on actually understanding it all.
I think in some ways, Ulysses, you can pick up at any point and just enjoy the rhythm of the words. And obviously, it's an intimidating and an ultimate book for many people, and they realize it, and it's so encompassing. But on the other hand, it can be done in bits, too, and enjoyed from that point of view.
But if you needed some help with Ulysses, there was the half-hour whirlwind tour at Mike and Molly's Irish Pub to explain it all. David Garrick and Dave Librick went through the book chapter by chapter, reading brief excerpts and keeping an irreverent scorecard of events.
One long gone, one feels that one is at one with one who
That's
wants...
really enough, Stephen. That's just enough. Okay, end of chapter 3. Has Bloom met Stephen? No. Has Molly cheated on her husband? Not yet. Has Leopold paid for the lemon soap? No. Has Stephen bathed yet? Well, let's see. Is it October? No, it's still June. Why did Molly marry Leopold anyway? We don't know. Chapter 4, Calypso. We finally meet the main
After the whirlwind tour, Champaign-Urbana's Bloomsday wound down with readings from the final chapter, featuring the sensual soliloquy of Leopold Bloom's wife, Molly.
And his heart was going like mad. And yes, I said, yes, I will, yes.
By this time of night, chilly temperatures kept the crowd in the beer garden down to just a handful, but a weary David Gehrig announced this year's Bloomsday a success.
I've only been reading Joyce now for about, 12 hours, 14 hours straight, so... but on the other hand, a whole lot of people have had a chance to participate. It's also nice to see the whole cycle of the story from start to finish. The little epic of the day of Dublin, of Bloomsday. It's nice to see it in miniature, and it's nice to have had a chance to celebrate it.
As Champaign-Urbana's Bloomsday centennial celebration came to a close, Gehrig says he was too exhausted to think about next year's celebration. But he conceded that another Champaign-Urbana Bloomsday in 2005 was inevitable. I'm Jim Meadows.
This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. Chick Tracks. They're little religious comics put out by the reclusive Jack Chick, and they seem to pop up just about everywhere. Bookstores, bus stations, laundromats, and the like. To say they profess a fire and brimstone fundamentalist Christian message is a bit of an understatement. Strange as it might seem, these tracks have become a pop culture collectible. Kurt Kirsteiner has just put out the unofficial guide to the art of Jack T. Chick. It's published by Schiffer. I talked with Kirsteiner and asked him first to explain exactly who Jack Chick is.
Well, the simple answer of who Jack Chick is that he's the most published living author today. He was outnumbered as far as sheer production by another religious publisher, a few years ago, and that was L. Ron Hubbard, who did the Scientology books. L. Ron had published almost 750 million copies of his works. But, of course, many of the people who bought his works were Scientologists who were buying multiple copies. Jack Chick's materials, on the other hand, are passed out by Christians who are sending them to Muslims and anyone else. So he's kind of the Henry Ford of publishing. His cheap tracks have managed to become the Model T of all printed matter. Everyone can afford them, and they've gone to virtually every country, and they are so inexpensive that anyone's able to afford to read them and pass them on.
So for people who haven't encountered Chick Tracks, and I'm sure there might be a few, explain and describe what they are.
Well, they're little 3x5-inch comic tracks. They're usually about 24 pages in length, and what makes them so effective is that unlike other tracks that are crammed with text and people pick them up and just kind of roll their eyes and put them back down, his are crammed with cartoon art, some by Jack Chick himself. In fact, probably about half, maybe even a little more than half, are drawn by him. But the others are drawn by Fred Carter, his other artist. And Chick's art's kind of crude, but Fred Carter's is really, really fantastic. So he's really got something for everybody in the visual art department.
Now, topic-wise, what sorts of things do they cover? Because some people sort of shy away from these tracks because of the subject matter.
Well, that's kind of the interesting thing about Jack Chick. He, like the the art that appeals to both connoisseurs of fine art and those who like sort of the scribbly, crude art, Jack Chick does a whole litany of different topics. They're all religious in nature. I mean, there's standard gospel track, the most common one being This Was Your Life, which is the story of a sinner who dies and his soul is taken to heaven and judged and he's cast into the lake of fire. That's kind of your conventional track. But he also does a bunch of what people would call conspiracy theories, which the Protestant tradition is rich in. Anything that's not biblical in nature is, in a fundamentalist Christian perspective, is usually considered satanic. So some secret fraternity like the Masons, that's not there to help little kids learn how to walk who have been involved in muscular dystrophy or something like that. The Shriners, no sir, that's actually a satanic plot to draw people away from believing standard Christian values and to be snookered into some sort of universal ecumenical, oh, we're all one under the great architect of the sky belief. Or it may be believing that the Catholic Church is also a satanic plot led not by the Pope to believe in Jesus as the Son of God, but led by the Antichrist to believe that Mary is some sort of secondary god, demigod, or co-redeemer. And he does this with a whole bunch of different controversial topics. It can be Dungeons and Dragons. It could be role-play game. Excuse me, not just role-play game, but the Jehovah's Witnesses. Or it might also be something like Judaism. People might think that that's, well, you're okay as long as you're a faithful Jew. Not so. If you don't believe that in Jesus Christ, you're going to go to hell. And Chick doesn't pull any punches. He's very politically incorrect in that way.
And also he tackles homosexuality, of course.
Oh, that was probably what put him on the... That's where he first started to get very controversial in the 1970s. He did this track called The Gay Blade. And when that came out, he's located there in Los Angeles, California. That made its own little earthquake of California magnitudes. The people started calling in and threatening to blow up Chick Publications, and at that point he realized that there really was no way for him to be true to his religious beliefs and not stomp on other people's toes.
Now here's the big question. Are these tracks, the Chick tracks, are they taken seriously?
Well, much the way that his tracks offer something for everyone, I think that many different groups get a lot out of them. Certainly, the biggest impact is from non-believers who may be susceptible to the Christian message but haven't taken the plunge. And then these tracks appear at a time that's very important to them in their lives. It may be somebody who's about to commit suicide and is reaching into the little compartment inside their car, that little glove compartment, in order to write a note to their children explaining why they're going to kill themselves. And then they discover this track that they forgot was there, and they read it, and they realize, oh, there's something more important in their life, and they become a Christian, that this is a true story that I'm telling you right now. Or there's all sorts of instances where someone's about to end their life or make some sort of big decision, and they encounter these omniscient, or I should say omnipresent, tracks that just seem to be strewn everywhere. And then, of course, there's the conspiracy buffs who also believe them. Or they may be someone who believes in just one little aspect of Chick's message and think, aha, you know, I knew this was the case, that role-play gaming really was responsible for leading these people to commit suicide as children. I've seen stories about that as well that had nothing to do with Christianity, just suggesting that role-play gaming was a satanic plot to lead children astray. So there's a lot of different people who glom on to part of Chick's message. But overall, I think it would be very easy to underestimate the big impact that Chick has had in Christian circles. They may not all walk away as fundamentalist Christians, but a lot of people have read Chick tracks, and that has had some or a big part of their decision to become a Christian.
Now, your book not only covers the history and the sort of themes of Chick, it's also a price guide. And it goes through basically all the Chick tracks that have been published, correct? And gives little synopsises.
That we know of. Yeah. We still discover, since the book's come out, we've found yet another track that no one knew about. So there's still some out there that people don't know about.
Well, why are these tracks so collectible?
Well, we mentioned all the different people who collect them, but the one group that we left off that's probably had the biggest impact are those who just collect comics, comic book collectors, people who don't agree with the message at all that Chick tracks have to say, just love the art. And whether it's Fred Carter's great art or Jack Chick's crude art, there's just something addictive about him. And he's done over 100 and, almost 180 different tracks now, not to mention the different variations he's done and the same stories that he's completely redrawn. If he did that, there's, probably 250 different tracks that he's done. But they're very collectible, and there's something very unique about United States. There is nothing else like Jack Chick in any other country. He's protected here by the religious freedom and freedom of the speech. And, of course, he's got this large audience and his self-publishing empire. I mean, when you stop and think about this guy out-publishing all the other great authors, and he's done it in a self-publishing manner, it's really astounding. So, and the fact that they've been given away and that they've been put out since the early 1960s, it's just something about it. Just there's no other substitute for it, and I'm convinced that 100 years from now, people are still going to look back at these things and say, "Well, you want to see something really unusual about the 20th century and the 21st century? Check these out."
Well, you've actually met him. He's a recluse, and he doesn't give interviews, and he sort of shies away from the public eye. But you actually have met him.
Well, I managed to do that because I knew one of his friends, and Reverend Rich Lee. And Jack Chick, many people would call him paranoid because he believes that the Jesuits are trying to murder him. He also knows he's very controversial, and he also knows that the media will never give him a fair shake. At least he has yet to see a impartial presentation of his opinions in the media. So there's just nothing in it for him to do interviews, because all they're going to do is make him look bad. But we have a big website called chickcomics.com, which is a big fan site, and he got through secondhand information that we were giving him a fair shake. We weren't endorsing his views, but we were presenting them honestly and letting people make their own opinions about it. So when I went out there with Reverend Rich Lee, he agreed to meet us. And instead of being this rabid fanatic who's trying to find out exactly what you believe and why don't you believe in this, he was actually a very pleasant gentleman and fun to talk to, had a good sense of humor, and he was the proverbial grandfather fellow. Chick, by the way, is childless, but maybe that's one of the reasons he so likes younger people. But he's enthusiastic, energetic. He's in his 80s now, so he's getting up there in years. But he was a real pleasure to meet.
And these are still being printed, the Chick tracks. And where can people find these? If they're, besides your website, where can people find these?
Well, of course, if you don't find them, they will probably find you. So many of them have been printed and placed in such odd places. But the easiest place to buy a large collection of them for 14 cents each, which, you can't beat that price. That's the retail price of a Chick track right now, is 14 cents. It's to order them directly from Chick Publications, and their website is chick.com. And you just go on the web and order an all assortment pack, which is usually 75 to 85 different tracks for less than, it's like $12.95 or something like that. The postage is really cheap too. So the Chick's prices can't be beaten. If you can't order them direct from the website, you can always call up Chick Publications, but that information is also on the website as well. And you can also probably get it from a toll-free directory. I'm not sure about that. But they're there in Los Angeles, and there's only one Chick Publications.
That was Kurt Kirsteiner, author of The Unofficial Guide to the Art of Jack T. Chick. It's published by Schiffer. You're listening to Sidetrack. Have you ever considered following a lifelong dream? A power plant worker from Southern Illinois is doing just that. Jeff Williams reports on the man known as the Prairie Crooner.
That's life, that's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May, but I know I'm gonna change my tune when I'm back on top in June. I said that's life.
Life is a funny thing that sometimes pops up out of nowhere and results in changes you'd never imagine. That's more or less the story of Clay City's Gary Burt, the Prairie Crooner.
Well, tell you the truth, I started back in high school several eons ago. I hate to admit my age, but I'm 52 years old. And the story goes that when I was, I had a vocal teacher who was a local high school principal down there. And I studied with him for about 4 years while I was in school. And one of the things he started me out on was on Frank Sinatra and the swing stop music that he grew up with. And I seemed to have a knack for it.
Back in the race, that's life.
That's life.
I tell you, I can't deny it.
Gary says he kind of put music on hold while he raised his family. His daughter will soon be graduating from SIU Carbondale, so all the kids will be out of the house. He picks up on the story from there.
I'd been playing around. I have a job in a power plant. I'm a boiler mechanic. And one of the things, about 6 years ago, they sent me off to school to an apprenticeship, and I was in St. Louis. I was stuck in St. Louis for like 9 weeks, you know, and I had all day I had to work, and then the evenings were free.
So Gary says he began to explore the karaoke scene in St. Louis. He says that began a number of events that fell together at the right time and place.
A friend of mine asked me, he liked what I was doing. He said, put together a half an hour show. So I ended up doing a piece for St. Jude's Hospital. I did a half an hour of nothing but Frank Sinatra style music.
Dates here and there at local fairs and other venues led Gary to send some of his work to a Nashville studio.
Lo and behold, I sent one to a recording studio called Soundwave down there. And Soundwave is a studio owned by Richard Adler. Richard Adler did all of Alison Krauss's Million and Gold Platinum records. He did Neil Young's stuff in the 70s. And anyway, Richard had a lady working for him who picked up my website after I sent her a card. They got me hooked up with an agent that specialized in specialty acts, which was what I needed.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea.
So Gary cut his first album over the course of several months and discovered he has a knack for fundraisers. Don't be surprised if you see Gary at events throughout Illinois, Indiana, and Missouri.
When somebody wants to book me for a special event, I'm not the umpteenth dozen bake sale they've had. I'm not the 1,500 country western band or rock group. I'm doing something that's a little different. I'm finding an audience for what I'm doing. So as long as there's an audience, I'm just going to keep playing. I'm having a good time.
In fact, Gary says he hopes to retire from his job at the power plant in a couple of years and devote himself full-time to his music.
If you've ever sat around and dreamed about something you always wanted to do and never thought you'd end up doing it, I'm living my dream. I am literally living my dream. I'm having a blast. If I go nowhere, fine. If I go all the way to Hollywood or wherever, that's okay too.
Gary Bird of Clay City, a.k.a. GB the Prairie Crooner, may very well be coming to a community near you this summer as he's living life his way. I'm Jeff Williams.
Fly me to the moon and let me swing upon the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. And a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Join us again the first Wednesday in August for another edition of Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.